Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development. It's Wednesday, May 6th. We have an important informational hearing today on post-secondary funding distribution models. I'll open that informational hearing. I expect that our other committee members will be joining us, but we've waited a little while. We want to get started because it's an important topic. We're going to start with Ben Cannon, Brian Fox, and Jim Middleton, please. And we have a couple of panels that will follow you, but as you get settled, I'll just let the committee know our expectation that we're going to spend the bulk of our time, I think, with you gentlemen in terms of the work you've been doing. Then we have a couple of panels that will sort of react and help us think through some of the ramifications of what you present. So we're glad you're here and eager to hear from you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'll allow the gentlemen to my left to introduce themselves in a few minutes as we move through the presentation. Appreciate, Mr. Chair, your willingness to hear this topic. It's one that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission has spent quite a bit of time with, and we look forward to sharing with you the progress that we've made in the work and engaging you in a conversation about work yet to come. So we are going to spend some time this morning explaining the efforts the Commission has made and is making to shift some of the way that the state distributes dollars to our colleges and universities. I want to note at the outset that we're really going to walk through two separate distribution models. They share some similarities, but they are focused first on the public universities, and Brian will speak to that, and second on the community colleges and their distribution formula, and Jim will speak to that. So while we're sort of under the umbrella of outcomes-focused distribution models, and we'll speak to some of the general principles that really underlie our efforts in both cases, in the first instance with our public universities, you'll hear about work that the Commission has to a large extent wrapped up to adopt a new funding model. And in the second case, when Jim talks to community colleges, you'll hear about really work that's still very much in process and undergoing quite a bit of discussion, deliberation, and I think still considerable efforts yet to come to potentially shift that distribution formula. So let me just say a few words at the outset about outcomes-based funding, which is really where how we've framed today's work. What we will describe are methods for the distribution of state resources to colleges and universities. We're going to talk about distribution formulas. And I think there's a tendency, perhaps, to see outcomes funding, those words, I think, often generate sort of a sense of philosophical or ideological sort of shift or focus on the part of advocates. I just want to try to frame this in terms of incentives that are embedded in any distribution formula, right? In fact, under an enrollment-based formula, there are incentives for institutions, whether we intend for those to exist or not. They're incentives typically to enroll students. And what we'll describe are potential, and in the case of the universities now, adopted shifts in the formula that create, in addition to enrollment incentives, incentives around student outcomes. I think what we're describing here represents a direction on the part of the Commission, and a direction that acknowledges that formulas contain incentives and that those incentives should, to the greatest extent possible, be aligned with the missions of institutions, which include enrollment but also include student success. I want to also stress at the outset that what we're describing here, that how the state distributes dollars, is not a substitute for the need for additional resources. There's a danger, I think, that outcomes distribution models are understood as or taken to be as sort of the answer to what higher education needs, the solution to improving higher education outcomes. And it is very clear to our commission that changing distribution models alone is an insufficient step to reaching our state's higher education goals. That, in fact, on its own, without additional resources, without additional supports for institutions, they will be inadequate to the job of reaching 40-40-20 or getting even on a trajectory for 40-40-20. So I want to really clearly stipulate at the outset this is not should not be seen as a substitute for increasing state investment in order to reach 40-40-20. I do want to note sort of some of the context for the work that's underway, particularly with respect to the universities, where we've undergone a pretty profound shift in the state oversight and control of our public universities, provide for much greater autonomy to those institutions. And for the commission, and I think for at least some members of this legislature, using our funding structure to incentivize state goals, namely around student success, is an appropriate alternative to tight state oversight of institutions or tight state management of institutions themselves. We've essentially, the legislature, the governor has said to our institutions, you may have greater autonomy. And the sort of corresponding part of that deal is to say, but the investments we make, we're going to focus in some key areas. We're going to use those investments to try to create incentives. We're not going to tell you how to spend those dollars directly, but we are going to distribute them in a way that creates incentives for you to focus on state goals around student success. And final sort of general point is that the shifts that we're talking about in how the state distributes dollars have sort of modest aims, right? Again, we shouldn't assume that what we're doing here is solving every higher education problem that exists. But they do reflect the particular state higher education context around the need, we believe, for greater levels of student success, not merely enrollment-focused state policy, but student success-focused state policy. And I want to talk just a couple of minutes about that context for our higher education goals in Oregon. So you know our 40-40-20 goal, and you've actually seen these depictions before early in this legislative session. I just want to highlight them again. The middle bar here really attempts to capture our progress towards that goal for our working age adult population, our all adults, essentially. And we know, of course, that we're a good distance from 40-40-20. We have the farthest to go on that middle 40, where we estimate about 17% of adult Oregonians have associate's degrees and certificates. What I think is particularly important for this conversation today is the number of, and here's the pipeline population. So these are recent high school graduates, and again, even farther to go with that group of students. What I think is particularly important for today's conversation are the bubbles that I'll fill in now. And if you're looking online or looking at OLIS, you'll see only a PDF that's a static version of this slide. This is the animated version that reveals the very large number of Oregon students, both adult age as well as or the all adult population as well as recent high school graduates, who have some college, no completion. Right? This really is the focus of the commission and really the context for what we're doing with these distribution models. Oregon's primary challenge in higher education is not to enroll more students. It's to help more students succeed in the completion of certificates and degrees. There are, of course, many other goals for higher ed, but this is where we're focused.
Do you have any more information on that? So the bar on the right is 35 in between. Is there any info on how much of that is community colleges and how much of that is a four-year institution? Or there are probably people who are in between, but is there any more insight into that number?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, yes. We have actually fairly detailed understanding of patterns of enrollment for this high school class that graduated almost 10 years ago and their higher education experience, both in-state and out-of-state, public and private, community college and four-year university, and the various rates of completion for them.
I don't need to take you off your outline there, but they'd be interested to follow up on that later on. Representative Wisnett?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, that's the group that we talked about, the reverse back to community college, to get, if we could, you know, get that system developed, we could make that, take that number to fill the 5% and make that bigger. If they're, you know, if they went to a four-year school but they have 2 years, if we can figure out how to make that system work to give them a 2-year, that's going to make that the 5% associate a much larger number.
Go ahead, thanks.
So again, this really being the context that our primary challenge is not an enrollment one. It is a student success one. It is a completion one. One more slide on context that just, again, reminds us of the changing demographics of Oregon. These are projections of our high school graduates by race and ethnicity. We, of course, understand that non-white students will comprise a greater percentage of Oregon's graduating high school students, seniors, and that creates greater opportunities and greater challenges, requires greater focus, we believe, on the part of the state and our institutions to support these populations in college or post-secondary success. In terms of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's role, I think you know and appreciate this, but I'll just remind the committee of our charter and our responsibilities under ORS 351.735. The commission that we work for is responsible for adopting rules that govern the distribution of state resources to colleges and universities. So the legislature chooses how much to invest, and then we, our commission, is responsible for rules that establish formulas for the allocation of those dollars to colleges and universities in separate funding streams. So there's been no discussion or effort to look at that sort of as a single funding stream. We get separate appropriations from the legislature for community colleges and universities, adopt separate funding formulas to govern the distribution of those dollars. The second part of this slide just refers to work that Brian will be going into more detail about in a couple of minutes, to spend the last year working on a new distribution model for our public universities, and you'll hear more about that shortly. Again, the notion of outcomes-based funding is that a portion of these distribution formulas would be not FTE-based, not enrollment-based, but would be based on student success, that those measures would be linked to the state's educational attainment goals, that it would direct a certain portion of state investment to essentially completions or progress towards completions, that it's designed to reward and reinforce institutional investments in student success and support services without mandating specific activity on the part of colleges and universities, but rewarding and incentivizing those choices that institutions make that do support student success, and that would be focused very clearly and explicitly on our equity goals in a way that our current enrollment formulas are not. 25 states currently have some form of outcomes-based funding within their distribution systems, and 9 more are currently developing them. Colorado recently approved an outcome-based funding formula for it, both its 2- and 4-year universities.
And you're going to get into the process about how you determined what those outcomes are and how they're measured and all that?
Mr. Chair, yes, and Brian and Jim, respectively, will be describing that in just a moment. You will hear and have heard, most likely, some of the concerns that get expressed around outcomes-based funding distribution models, and we take those very seriously and think they are important to recognize and address. I've mentioned a couple of them here. One around equity and access, the concern essentially that if you're rewarding or incentivizing student completion, institutions will serve those who are easiest to serve. And we've attempted to address that through weighting, putting particular rates around low-income students, non-white students, around rural students, around veteran students, and funding those at their success at a higher level. A secondary concern or a second concern around degree program quality, essentially that the institutions will have an incentive to lower standards in order to produce more student success. A lot that we could say about that we haven't attempted in the university work or that you'll hear or that described. We haven't attempted to take that on directly within the formula, but we are working very closely with the institutions, their faculty, their administrators, and our staff to develop annual evaluations and other methods for holding universities responsible for continuing the high level of academic quality that they have today. Really, my final point is a suggestion to this commission and or to this committee that it's the same one that we've made to our commission, that when you consider the merits or drawbacks of shifting a portion of our funding distribution system to outcomes, that you apply the same lens to our current enrollment-based distribution formula. It's tempting to sort of look at outcomes-based funding in a vacuum and say, well, this is good, this is bad. Well, there are challenges with our current formula as well. And so we've done a very simple sort of side-by-side with enrollment-based distribution for, methods on the left and outcomes-based distribution methods on the right, and then some ways of thinking about them. So are there incentives to increase student success? Does the formula include incentives to increase student success? Well, an enrollment-based formula does not. An outcomes-based does. Does the formula contain incentives to increase enrollment? An enrollment formula very clearly creates that incentive. It's not that imperative for institutions to really chase enrollment in order to access state dollars and maintain or increase their state funding. An outcomes-based distribution system does not. Incentives for academic quality, well, neither formula, without a lot of work at least, really contains incentives. Neither model contains incentives within the distribution system to maintain or increase academic quality. Adjustments or weights for underrepresented students, the enrollment-based formulas that our colleges and universities have had have not adjustments or weights for underrepresented students. They could, but they haven't. Our outcomes-based distribution system very clearly does. And likewise around low-income students. Finally, do they reflect institutional missions? Well, yes, an enrollment-based funding model does reflect the portion of the institutional mission that's focused on access, on enrollment, on serving larger numbers of students. An outcomes-based method also supports that portion of an institutional mission that's focused on student success. And the fact that there are yeses here underscores why the work that you'll hear about, the models that you'll hear about from Brian and from Jim, contain both elements. They contain enrollment-based elements as well as outcome-based elements to more clearly and thoroughly reflect institutional missions that are both access and student success and completion.
To what degree do you think the no on enrollment in the outcome-based column could be a yes based on the fact that if you get more enrollments are necessary for completions?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I think that's right, that there is clearly a dependency on enrollment in order to generate additional completions. And so this likely oversimplifies that distinction. I think
get the contrast, but yeah, I just want to make sure I wasn't missing something.
Yep. Okay. I'm gonna skip past the last slide, which just some of you know, Dennis Jones from National Center for Higher Education Management and Statistics, I think.
Systems.
Thank you. Who has helped to guide us and other states and work around outcomes funding, a few of the key principles that he asked us to consider from the outset that we've embedded into the work and tried to take very seriously. We've had support from not only him but other national folks who have worked in this vein, and hope that and believe that what we've done has been a thoughtful and responsible way of approaching what is a very sensitive and can be quite a difficult topic.
So at this point, what do you mean by angst?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I suspect you'll hear a little bit more about that later in today's hearing.
Okay.
But the concern that I think is really important to take very seriously, to understand, and to attempt to address as you work through some pretty difficult work here. So with that, I'm going to ask Brian to describe the work that the commission has now completed to adopt a new distribution model for our public universities specifically.
And before we make that transition, let me just see if the committee has any questions for Ben before we do. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Representative Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Fox, Director of Budget and Finance for the Public Universities. I actually want to step back to a question that you had about angst, because I think it is having sort of led the charge on this for most of the last year. I've been the brunt of a lot of that angst. And it's perfectly reasonable. I think the institutions for 15 years have had a resource allocation model, the RAM, which is focused on enrollment. Folks know what it is. They know how to optimize against it. They know what to do. And so anytime you're changing the rules of the road, folks are going to be nervous, and perfectly reasonably so. And I think what we have done through a long and iterative process is to try and work through that angst, understand where there are potential issues, where you can negate them, work against them, make sure that you get rid of any malincentives, and then allow institutions the time and the understanding to transition to a new structure. So I think that angst is really important to understand, but also something that can be worked through with open and honest and clear dialogue. And so with that, I think it's worth sort of a little highlight on what is or what was. So the resource allocation model, RAM, was created in the late 90s and is by and large an enrollment-driven model. There's kind of two primary functions. About 70% of it is enrollment-driven. It's cost-weighted, so different programs have different costs at different levels, so lower division, upper division, and advanced study sort of recognizes that, allows institutions to understand what their enrollment mix will be, and state allocations are driven out that way. There's also a second kind of major portion of that, and that's line item funding. Some of that flows through in support for the regional institutions, research support, and really sort of mission or public service driven funding. And then there's a small portion that came in 4 or 5 years ago, about 1%. That's focused on degree completion, both degree completion for resident students and for underrepresented minority students and low-income students. It's about 1%. And so I think this is where you come back to that question of what is the funding model ought to represent the state's interest, and is the state's interest 1% on completion? And then a final point, which I think is important to stress, is that the RAM uses single-year data. So the enrollment you have this year is what gets funded. That creates a whole lot of volatility in the system. So that if your enrollment goes up, more funds flow your way. If enrollment goes down, your funding from the state decreases significantly, and that's particularly important for institutions when they see enrollment declines, because their tuition goes down as well. So it's really it's a one-two punch. Both the tuition funds go down and the state resources go down at the same time and exacerbate budget deficits or budget issues. And we've seen that at some of our institutions. So shifting to the work group process, it was convened.
I'd interrupt for just a second. Representative Wisner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Go back to your last slide, please. 70, 29, and 1.5 is more than 100%.
There's some rounding in there. I can provide exact numbers.
thank you. The 29%, that you say regional support, that includes Oregon OSU Extension, or what is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it includes OSU Cascades, has some amount of regional support funding at a discounted rate to what the other institutions are.
I'm familiar with that one because, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, please.
I'm familiar with that because we didn't have year one and two. We start with three and four, so that was why I understand that. But I thought, like, in the budget, it has a list of things, regional support. I think the Shakespeare Theater, is that what, or is this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, that's a portion of it, really the public service portion, and it ranges. So there's things as small as $60,000 a year for new leadership Oregon and Portland State.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And who authorizes the expenditure for that?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, in the past, it's been the State Board of Higher Ed had sort of policy discretion to fund those and at what level they saw fit. That falls through the transition to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That discretion falls to the HEC. Many of those programs have been legislatively created. Some have not, but a significant portion of those have and are being carried forward in the process.
Thank you. Just to follow up, finish this. So the public service funding items, part of the 29%, it will now be responsibility of the HEC to review those and approve those, whether they're whether they're legislatively approved or not?
Yes, sir.
Will there be standards, or will the public know what decisions were used to make those allocations?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Reed, I'll just jump in here. I think it's actually a very important set of questions associated with what is remains a fairly significant chunk of the state appropriation to universities that comes through this funding line. And yes, the commission between now and 2017 will undertake a thorough process to evaluate and ultimately decide going forward on what sort of public service related programs that are under our jurisdiction ought to continue. So, yes, we're planning for a process that will include that evaluation.
Sorry, just a last statement, and I'll leave this. Would the HEC concur that anything on there should have legislative authorization?
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, the HEC would certainly agree that anything that has legislative authorization and direction must be included there. There may be other items, as there are today, that reflect commission or state or institutional priorities that don't have that legislative imprint that ought still to be continue to be funded through that funding line.
Thank you for your response.
Thank you. Let's go back to to our regularly scheduled
program. Thank you. So the HEC convened a work group of senior financial, academic, and student affairs administrators from each of the seven institutions, really running the gamut of skill sets and experiences, as well as leadership from the Oregon Student Association and the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, to sit on a technical work group to advise the executive director on the development of a model. It's really our job over a series of 9 months, beginning in June of last year, to put together what an outcomes-based funding model or funding model that reflects the principles that I'll walk through in a second would look like for the state. We started the process by reviewing what other states have done. This is that some states have gone further than others. Roughly half of the states in the nation have some form of outcomes-based funding, some form of focus on completion. And so we have an opportunity to cherry-pick what's working in other states and then mold that to the institutional context. Oregon is different. Every state is different from the others. So make sure that we can take what works in other places, drop away what doesn't, and then mold that to the institutional context of Oregon. The principles that the HEC articulated for the work group to focus on is really the first to comport with the HEC strategic plan, and importantly, the OEIB's equity alliance, that this needed to be done with an equity focus, that for us to reach 40-40-20, it's about reaching the students who either don't go or don't complete today. And that really has been the lens which the work group focused on and the HEC is focused on. Second, that it focused on student access and success, again, focusing on underrepresented populations, that it encouraged high demand and high reward degrees, recognizing there's a significant underproduction within the state of certain key skill sets, and that we should focus and recognize those. We also should recognize and reward the differentiation between institutional missions. What we don't want to do is force institutions to look like each other, to act like each other, but to reward them for finding their niches, finding their markets, finding the sort of students that they serve best, and reward them for both enrolling and completing them. That we use clearly defined available data, that it be as clear and simple as possible. And then lastly, that we utilize a phase-in period to ensure stability, that institutions have time in the fiscal space to transition, to focus on what a new funding formula means, and then to implement and move forward over time. So what is the student success and completion model? There's really three portions, and part of it's going to sound really similar, because this is very much an evolutionary model, not a revolutionary model. This takes what was working in the resource allocation model and moves it forward. It has three main components. One is mission differentiation funding, and that's exactly what Representative Wisnett had questions about. It's regional, it's funding for the regional institutions, it's funding for research, it's funding for the public service mission of the institutions. Next is activity-based funding. This is really enrollment funding. This looks and acts and smells a whole lot like the RAM. So folks will be very comfortable and understand how that portion of it works. And then the last piece, sort of the evolutionary leap, sort of the move forward, is completion funding, which invests in degrees degree and certificate completion of resident students, with a particular emphasis on underrepresented students, and we'll walk through the definition of that in a moment, and then priority degree areas. We've also included a transition mechanism that smooths the transition from the RAM to the SSCM, with a graduated increase so that you don't start out flipping the switch, but you slowly move from some amount of completion funding to a larger amount over a set number of years. So institutions understand what's this going to look like in the future, but have time to adjust. And then lastly, that you include really brackets, a stop loss and stop gain, to ensure that there's no downward shock to an institution, also not too much of an upward shock to an institution, so that folks, everyone knows that they're not going to receive less than X amount, and in fact, the stop loss is set at a gain. So everyone will receive new money, will receive real increases in state funding next year, assuming the co-chair's budget, but even without it, everyone will see an increase. And then importantly, the student success and completion model uses a three-year rolling average, which reduces that volatility, it increases predictability. What it does is it trades off some responsiveness for stability for institutions, and that was a trade-off as we worked with the leadership from each of the institutions they wanted to make. So they recognize that it's important to have that sort of predictability when they make long-term investments in faculty, long-term investments in students, that kind of stability is important. So within the mission differentiation allocation, there's really three types. Again, regional support focuses on the technical and regional institutions and OSU Cascades. And this is recognizing there's a higher cost mission. These institutions aren't reaching an economy of scale, which the larger institutions do, and also serve a population that is hard to reach. Second is research support, which allocates funds to all of seven institutions, but primarily at the three large institutions, and that recognizes that research is a key part of an institution's mission. And then lastly, this mission support, which recognizes things that don't really fit well into formulaic structure, whether that's JPR at Southern Oregon or Vet Diagnostic Lab, which serves really a statewide role at Oregon State. Funding is indexed to the Portland CPI, so it will increase with inflation over time, and it comes off the top. So this, if funding levels go up, it doesn't increase as fast. If funding levels go down, it doesn't decrease as fast. And then lastly, and very importantly, is that true shared services will be incorporated into the regional support. I know that there's discussion, both legislatively and otherwise, that there are additional costs that will be driven down to the regional institutions through the governance transition. We want to make sure that those are supported and funded. The activity-based allocation. Again, this replicates the cost-weighted approach within the old funding model. It supports and incentivizes enrollment, a key part of an institution's mission and one that is necessary. You have to enroll students to complete them. That's an important part. That dovetails with tuition, which is really enrollment-driven funding. So there's a strong incentive for institutions to continue and expand enrollment. And this is an area where you don't want to create awkward incentives. And so if you got rid of enrollment funding, you'd create an awkwardness where institutions may not want to work together as much to share those funding if only the person sort of that gets the completion gets the dollars. I want to make sure that there's enough enrollment funding. The institutions still have sort of good reason to work together. They can find funding splits that work. And again, this focuses on resident students. The last piece is that these cost-weighting factors were developed in the late 90s. But they need to be updated, and so we're going to convene a work group over the next year to do so. The institutions are on board to do that and recognize that it works, but we also need to update it for future. And then the last part, the new part, is really the completion-focused area. Degrees at all levels, bachelor's through PhD, including graduate certificates, advanced degrees for resident students. Cost adjustments are made to reflect the program's duration, the program type, and for transfer students. And then importantly, additional weighting is provided for traditionally underserved populations, those that aren't enrolling and completing at the same rate as others today. Low-income students, underrepresented minority students, rural, veteran students, all of which are very clear, do not complete, do not enroll at the same rates as other students, need additional support. And we wanted to provide enough funding the institutions can go back, design programs, have the funding necessary for them to hire counselors, to hire the support services needed, to invest in students. I think the worst case scenario is that you enroll a student, they take out $10,000 or $15,000 worth of debt, they get a couple years in, and then they end up in that shaded 35% where they went, but they didn't get there. It's pretty clear that the economic returns to higher education tend to accrue with the degree. So we want to make sure that those supports are available and that the state is funding that and that institutions can really make those investments in students. And then lastly, additional weighting is provided for students who complete in areas of critical need for the state, STEM, healthcare, bilingual education, recognizing that there are real needs from employers, there are real needs in the labor force, there are jobs that are going unfilled, and that those programs are more costly or serve a critical need for the state.
So before you go to the transition, I have a question that might be reserved for Mr. Middleton, but you talk about degrees, and obviously that makes sense. I wonder if there is also has also been consideration around certificates and other forms of completion that aren't just degrees.
Certainly, Representative Reed, what we have done within this model is ensure that with any data point, there's sort of a central check on it. What you've seen in some other states is that as you've rewarded one thing, if you don't have a tight hold on it, institutions create more of them. So in Tennessee, for example, they rewarded certificates, didn't have a tight definition of what certificates were. It turned out that everything was a certificate after that. So what we have done is focus on degrees, which have sort of a central check coming through the HEC, and then graduate certificates, which have a central check at the Provost Council, but not undergraduate certificates, which institutions can package and create without that sort of central tendency. But that's a key concern piece, and particularly with the community colleges, I think.
We'll come back to that. Thanks.
And we've sort of walked...
Technical questions, sorry. I wasn't looking down the row. Representative Nierman, and then was it Representative Gagos or Representative Johnson?
I can go.
Both.
Yeah,
let's start with Representative Nierman. And then
thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Fox, how does the state define, or how does the higher education define critical need? Which things? I'm worried about the state kind of being behind the curve and picking winners and losers and kind of missing the boat on that. So how do
you... Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman. What we've done is we had engaged earlier this year Echo Northwest and the Employment Department to look at critical needs within the state, and it was lined up very closely with what you would traditionally call STEM, healthcare. So we felt comfortable moving forward. We had definitions from the university system around those. In the future, what we've done, and I'll actually talk about this in the evaluation process for the model, we're going to need to engage with other stakeholders, whether that's the Oregon Talent Council, which is sort of walking its way through legislation, with the Employment Department, with employers, to make sure that that is sufficiently nimble, that those definitions change enough to represent the needs of Oregon industry, but are also sufficiently stable so that institutions can make long-term investments. That's an area where we're going to need to, over time, develop those relationships so we can be nimble and responsive, but have continuity.
Thank you. Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to completion being a focus, what focus is there on simply retention? And obviously, folks aren't going to complete if they don't stay in the system, but one of my great frustrations is seeing, I think, the different levels to which universities and colleges employ academic advisors and counselors and so forth, just to make sure that students are getting timely and good information about what decisions they ought to make about courses, all the other wraparound services, how do they access those, what are their needs and so forth. And frankly, I'm getting a little bit tired of being lobbied for this capital construction project or that shiny object when I ask how you doing on the counseling advising side, and they said, well, we wish we had more money for FTE. And you know, there are some things we know work, and I wonder, has it ever been considered that there should be a basic, you know, per student requirement, X number of FTE to serve those students well? I mean, there's got to be a model out there somewhere that we can grab from somewhere, whether it's Tennessee or whatever state, Colorado, that says, you know, this is a value, this is a priority. We've put this money here, and because since we've done that, we see our retention rates going through the roof, and therefore, in a few years, our completion rates are looking really good now, too. Is that the conversation that the HEC is engaged in?
So, Representative Reed, Representative Johnson. So what we have tried to do, I think there's an a balance that we're walking. One is to not be prescriptive in the operations of institutions, sort of thou shalt do X, but then providing the funding structures that incentivize institutions to do X, right? And so by focusing on completion, you're creating the maximum incentive for institutions to invest in those sort of retention efforts. And that became very clear as we worked through the work group. I hope some folks on the work group will probably take a point of pride in this. We have some crafty folks on there, right, whose jobs really are to make the investments, to decide where dollars go within their institution, and to optimize their funding levels. And really, with any funding model, it creates a gameable structure. Folks are going to game it in the right way. And there's a fellow from Western Oregon who does their student success initiatives that was on the committee. He is enamored with this because it's going to give him an opportunity to go to his finance VP and say, listen, if we can invest in one more student success counselor, guidance counselor, it's going to cost us X. They get 8 more students through to completion. They've paid for themselves. I think they can get 15. Mm-hmm. It's going to create more resources for our institution. And that's the sort of thinking that we want to enable institutions to do. But we also don't want to force an institution to do one thing when maybe that's not their critical bottleneck. And we heard earlier this year from the institutions on how they would invest. They're very different from institution to institution because of the different student bodies they serve. So that's the balance we're trying to strike.
Be continued.
Yes, indeed. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, just a brief question. I think kind of got answered, but it has to. I like the term nimble. I like that. But my question. Well, two questions really. One has to do with how we're actually preparing students. I mean, students are going to be coming in at different levels of ability and so on. And so it seems to me that really looking at the developments within K-12 as well. In terms of your planning, the other question I have it has to do with then the prioritization with regard to degree areas and so on. It seems to me that, I mean, if I were advising a young person right now about what school to go to, I mean, we kind of know what schools emphasize STEM or what schools emphasize healthcare and so on. So, it seems to me that schools are, and then if I was a president, then I would be thinking about hiring faculty. That are going to address some of those high priority areas. I don't know. I'm just trying to think through what this might mean in terms of competition, in terms of a formula, and so on. If you have any comment on that.
Yeah, Representative Reed, Representative Cayugas. This will, with any funding shift, it will encourage institutions to rethink what it is that they are being funded for, what can they afford, what they ought to focus on. So I think part of that will be focusing on that transition time from high schools, from community colleges, to ensure that institutions that students are up to speed, can get ready to run, and can complete in 4 years or as quickly as possible. I think as we focus on quality, this is why it's important that we have sort of a tight focus around quality in other areas. You don't want folks just to speed through. You want to do it in a really strong way. When it comes to STEM, I will say there was a significant amount of skepticism from some of the institutions that the funding is enough, that the costs are so high in many of those areas that even with the sort of bonus provided from the state, that it would be sufficient to cover incremental costs. We certainly hope that it is and are encouraging that focus.
So I'm starting to watch the clock a little.
Yeah.
I think we should limit our questions and make sure we get through this and then hear it from our other panels too.
So I'll just make very quick. We've talked about sort of the bracketing and the stop loss and stop gain and then the phasing in. So we've sort of talked about this transition. I think it's important to recognize that transition is there so you have stability. And then we have information. The next two slides are really about current funding and then next year's funding. So if you go to the next slide, the black and the green at the bottom largely stay the same. That yellow at the top or that orange, this is the new portion. And this is the first year that will grow, that will take over more of the green over time. But that's sort of the change. Every institution is forecast, assuming the co-chair's budget framework, to receive additional resources at varying amounts. And then that blue tranche at the top of the technical and regional institutions, that's the amount of increase that's related to shared services. And then I'll just walk through the evaluation framework real quick. Anytime there's a change, you're going to need to go in and revamp and tinker and tighten here and loosen there. And so every 2 years, the HEC will engage, and this is structured within the rule that creates the model. Every 2 years, we'll engage in sort of an evaluation process, talk with the institutions, use our internal research, institutional research capabilities to see what's happening, adjust where we need to, and then every 6 years, do a wholesale re-engagement of the model, make sure that we're that it fits with where the state is headed, what are the key priorities. And with that, I'm open to questions if there are any.
Questions? Representative Hayden.
I brought this question up before, but I do have a question about the 40-40-20. We referenced that a lot as one of the goals. And in that middle 40, my question regards to earning, the goal is to earn an associate's degree or a post-secondary education. Would there be ever flexibility to add career technology or STEM into that 40 category just to give credit to some of these particular goals that people have for their education may not fall into that associate degree, yet the jobs that they achieve in that, in some of the tech industries, science industries, welding, linemen, journeymen, things like that, those jobs are certainly equivalent to the associate degrees. It seems like if we had that as part of the 40-40-20, we might bring some more substance to bringing those types of things forward, which I think is important.
Representative Hayden, Chair Reed, Ben Cannon, Executive Director HEC, and I think it's an important point. Appreciate that the legislative definition of 40-40-20 acknowledges and highlights the role that certificates, including CTE certificates of the type that you describe, are included within the middle 40. So too are apprenticeships as a result of a modification to that goal that the legislature recently made. It leaves the statutory definition, leaves the sort of definition of certificates open enough for the commission or the OEIB or others to attempt to sort of more clearly define. And the perspective that our commission has taken is that it should be a very broad definition that includes the types of licenses and certificates I think that you're concerned for, including in the middle 40, especially understanding their impact on earnings and well-being.
Thank you. Let's keep up the momentum. Middleton.
For the record, I'm Jim Middleton, Interim Commissioner, Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnett, Committee. Like to update you on where we are in the continuing saga of discussion of the community college element in this direction. Our first thing to do is look at where we are with our current status. With the current distribution system, and again, we have a distribution, not a funding system. Legislatively, you define the size of the pie. We then slice that pie up. So no matter what we do, it doesn't make the pie any bigger. And the only way anybody gets any more is that somebody loses something. So it is always in that competitive moving funds from one institution to another. Currently, the only thing we look at is enrollment in the fourth week of the term. We take a snapshot at that point in time. Functionally, at the bottom line, everything else is worthless or irrelevant. The only thing we look at is fourth week enrollment. So the issue is, can we define other elements to complement but not fully replace that? In fact, though I've been an advocate as we've discussed this for about 3 years, I think I would vehemently go to the other side if we said enrollment doesn't matter and it's only these outcomes. I think that is destructive. So it's how do we complement, how do we add to, how do we refine? And as we explore that path, it's looking for that Goldilocks point. Not too much, not too little, not too hot, not too cold. So don't get caught up in the enthusiasm and flush everything that we've got to replace it with something else. And so I think that's what we've been struggling with and arm wrestling over for, frankly, about a 3-year period as the community colleges have been looking at this. So literally, where are we today? With HEC support and with Ben's support, the discussion with the presidents, we have extended this beyond the legislative session time. Our original goal was to complete this process and change the OAR by June 30 of this year. We felt we could not get all of the technical data and staff stakeholder input done and maintain that timeline. So we have slowed the process down or extended the process a bit more. We're in the process of establishing a technical work group to really dive into the data. Sometimes it's seductive to think you've just defined the area and you've defined some criteria and everything will fall in line. And I think as we've looked at this, we've felt that some of those data points need to be looked at much more carefully. Originally, we went to the Achievement Compact data points, and there was some question about whether or not those are as valid and consistent as we would hope. And so we're trying to kick the tires on those and determine, is this the best measure? Is it consistent? Is it reliable? Is it fair to all colleges? And then we also need to structure more formal stakeholder review and input before HEC makes a decision. And this has been one of those chicken-egg kind of elements. You can't hold a hearing until you know what the proposal is. And we really weren't close enough yet to get that and be done by June 30. So I'd like to think it's a pause to do it right or at least do it better rather than doing it quickly. So what we'll discuss is what we have at this point. Assuming that this went ahead, 2015-16, even if we had approved changes by June, would have been distributed exactly the same as historically. 2016-17 was targeted, if HEC approves any outcomes-based formula, would be the first year of this. So the technical work group, we were hoping to do our work May through August, stakeholder input September, October, then have HEC review and adopt the targeted changes by December. What that would do then is to allow HEC to calculate and distribute to all of the colleges a shadow distribution that would not be used for 15-16, but would be able to say, if we did this year, this is what it would have looked at. And it assists the colleges as they do their budget planning for 16-17. Again, current system, as we look at the public resource section, remember a significant, almost 50% of the community college funds are tuition and fees. So what we are talking about is only that portion that distributes the state funds, looking at and considering what are the local property taxes. So for each college, the calculation considers the total resources that are both the state funds and the local property taxes. The distribution formula defines what is the total amount that each institution should receive. It's like defining how big the glass is. Then we look at how much property tax fills the glass, and the remainder is the state funds. And because individual community colleges get significantly different amounts from their local contribution, we see different percentages college to college of how much percentage of funding is state. But what we get is that a calculated amount that is both the state and the local property tax. Just as Ben did
just a moment, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have a question for him. Was Dr. Melton, thank you. Your black box is the same on the last slide. That's the same as K-12. Go back one slide, please. That's the same as K-12.
Yes.
The situation we were in Central Oregon was that our property tax put us over that we were getting very little state money.
Correct.
But didn't that also include some local option bonds that we passed?
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnant, actually No, it did not, because the overhead on that was so small coming up against the limitations that, frankly, the cost of doing that election would produce very little additional.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sure. So clarify, it's only the property tax and whatever the state gives is what you're getting. Not that, but the property tax counts against the state's contribution, not any other bonds that we pass or anything.
Correct.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And we follow up, Mr. Chair. And we do in K-12 have some situations where local property tax, the school district gets no state funding at all. Very few. I think there's one or two districts that occurs. So for those districts that are the community college taxing districts that do have large property tax, then there will be a chance that we could not receive state funding. Do you think that in your discussions, are you going to look at saying there's a minimum you should get or something like that from the state?
Chair Reed, Representative Whitson, at this point, I think that we're not close to that. A few years ago, I thought that would happen with Central and one or two of the others, but at this point, we're not close to that threshold.
Right, the values are going back up. Thank you.
Trying to move quickly here. Comparison-wise, between the current system and what we're looking at, the current system does have base funding that looks at, there's a certain minimal amount for opening the doors that are needed. That continues under outcomes. Three-year rolling average to smooth out those highs and lows. That continues. Currently, 100% of that stake in local is merely the enrollment. The proposal was that would be 70%. The current system, none is on outcomes. The proposal was 30% be that. There is currently no adjustment for either underrepresented or low income, and there would be under the outcomes. And there is a local option that is not the local tax option, but allows colleges under what we've been discussing to tailor it somewhat. There were seven category areas that we were looking at our counting our work with the high schools, accelerated learning, dual enrollment of high school students, developmental ed, remedial education success. How are we doing with those students that start out with needing remediation? Those who achieve 15 or 30 credits within the year, those who get a certificate or Oregon transfer model degrees, transfer, and we were looking at job placement and workforce training, but we're not yet satisfied with the measures in that area to include those.
Did you, when you said were, does that mean you are no longer, or you're still considering?
They're still on the under consider them, and if we can find a valid, consistent measure, I think there would be a recommendation to include those. There were concerns about how strong the measure was. The local weighting. The proposal there was that HEC would burn in, that you would need to allocate 75% of your total weighting to allocated areas, but you could then adjust. And so that other 25%, colleges could emphasize one element that would make them a bit more distinctive. So if it was a college that worked very, very heavily with their school districts, they could weight that a bit heavier. If it was one that was more focused on degree production, they could wait in that direction. Then also, our low-income Pell students and our underrepresented students, there would be a 40% additive bonus as far as that's concerned. So if you had a underrepresented low-income student, success by that student would count 1.8% compared to the standard. Phase-in, very similar to the university model. The first year would be that learning year. The first year there would be 1.5% stop loss, meaning no college would lose more than 1.5% of their funding compared to enrollment only. That would grow to 3% to 4.5%, and then full implementation in 2019. And a point of emphasis is, even from an advocate's point of view, even those who may strongly think this is the best thing to do, outcomes-based funding by itself does nothing to leverage the changes. It's a piece of the issue. It may be a necessary, it may be a first step, but it's also very important that we provide support for research, predictive analytics, developing communities of practice, supporting institutional change at the local level. Those are all at least equally, if not more important, than just changing the distribution rules. Partly in recognition of that, the community college presidents have recommended and supported increasing our strategic fund from 1% to 1.5% to fund some of those other change management and change support initiatives. In support of your time agenda, I'll open up for any additional questions.
Thank you. Ordinarily, I think I would ask for questions. I hope everybody's been asking their questions as they occurred to Representative Wisley. Let's be quick. We got two other panels. Go ahead.
Is your work group looking at the fifth-year high school student and how you're going to do that funding? Is that part of your task? It's a big issue, I know, in our district.
What we would, not fifth year, but we would be looking at what our, that's part of what that definition element is what should we count, which elements should, which are most appropriate to include.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Our next panel is Mary Spilde, Kevin Fury, and Ramin Farmanpour. Please. So we've got about 25 minutes, and we've got six folks. I hope you might be able to hit about 3 minutes, and that'll leave time for a couple of questions. Madam President, do you want to start us off?
I will. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisdom, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Spilde. I'm president of Lane Community College in Eugene. And I'd like to urge you to thoroughly review all of the research and assess the efficacy of this type of distribution formula before moving forward. I'm opposed to performance-based funding or outcomes-based funding, and in the absence of a clearly articulated definition, I believe that they're the same. I believe in accountability, transparency, improvement. We're all committed to increasing efficiency and use evidence-based approaches to improve student outcomes. And I'm certainly not defending the status quo, and I can give you lots of evidence about how community colleges have been innovating on student success. We're using many nationally validated best practices over the last few years, even with the dramatic state disinvestment. And I would say that community colleges don't need to be incented to do what we're already doing, which is focusing on student success and progression towards degrees and certificates. We know what needs to be done. The barrier really is the lack of funding to get all of our initiatives to scale. Generally, if you look at the research on motivation, even in the business world, they are finding that pay for performance doesn't work. The work of Dan Ariely, the Princeton economist, shows that, in fact, pay for performance is leading to negative performance, and that a carrot and stick approach might have worked for 20th century rote jobs, but for the complex adaptive organizations of the 21st century, when you need creativity, responsiveness, adaptability, you need mastery and a sense of purpose. To make necessary changes, not schemes like pay-for-performance or performance-based funding. Yes, the current formula has flaws, and it's been suggested that there are incentives through an enrollment-based funding formula. While that may be true, even if it is true, it's really not relevant because community colleges are already absolutely focused on student success and have implemented a myriad of programs to try and improve student success. So the current formula has flaws, but let's not do more of the wrong things. Performance-based funding is a band-aid that is very unlikely to accomplish the state's goals. And let's just look for a minute at the research on performance-based funding. What evidence is being used that supports performance-based funding as a meaningful strategy for increasing educational achievement? There are multiple studies, and I've brought a few. This is about a third of the studies that have been written on the failure of performance-based funding. The most recent study, though, by the Community College Research Center at Columbia University state that there is no research that definitively establishes that performance-based funding has resulted in significant improvement in student outcomes. In fact, the research shows that this scheme has minimal or no impact on student learning outcomes. And since student learning outcomes must be the basis for institutional effectiveness, it makes no sense to implement a strategy that is not proven to make a difference.
If you could start to wrap up, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
So I would just say that, you know, faced with the stark fact of the lack of evidence for performance-based funding, proponents have claimed that if we move to so-called performance-based funding 2.0, we could begin to see improvement. But that hasn't been researched. I would just like to suggest that there are other policy levers that we can use for improvement. I'm asking that at a time when you're asking us to be more evidence-based, that you hold yourself to the same standard and take the time to consider the research, learn from it, and reach conclusions that will enhance our ability to improve student achievement. Oregon should set itself apart from other states by taking the time to develop rational models of funding distribution rather than adopting a practice that, at least to this date, is not supported by evidence, and I believe we deserve no less.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Dr. Farmanport?
Chair Reed and House Higher Education Committee members, for the record, my name is Ramin Farahmanpour. I'm a professor at Portland State University in the Post-Secondary Adult and Continuing Education Program in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at Portland Leadership and Policy. I've published over four books, over 100 essays, articles, book chapters, and opinion pieces in 9 languages on different topics, including higher education policy and finance. I'm here today to share my concerns with Oregon's move toward outcome-based funding for higher education. Student enrollment has traditionally driven state support for public higher education. Now, however, a proposed new outcome-based funding model aims to replace the old system. One must ask whether the HCC's decision to adopt a formula that pays universities and community colleges for the number of degrees it produces will actually improve the state's college graduation rates. Heck admits that outcome-based funding will force Oregon's 7 public universities to compete with one another over limited resources. And even though the Commission acknowledges that this model is suboptimal, it plans to push forward with the proposal anyway. The State Higher Education Executive Officers Association, which monitors higher education finance, reports that the surge of student enrollment in Oregon has outpaced state support. Since the 2007 recession, full-time student enrollment increased by 27.7%, while state and local support fell by 30%. Among states, Oregon ranks 33rd in support for public higher education. The state allocates just 5% of its tax revenues and lottery profits to this sector, below the 5.8% national average. Against this backdrop of underfunding, outcome-based allocations force colleges to focus on quantity, not quality, of degrees awarded. Furthermore, a consequence of penalizing institutions for failing to meet unrealistic churn rates may be tempted to inflate grades to boost student degree attainment. More important, outcome-based funding doesn't account for the soaring college tuition that most students can't afford without relying on student loans, nor does it acknowledge that a growing number are non-traditional and first-generation college students who must work full-time to support themselves and their families, who require the institution to expend more resources to provide support. Because outcome-based funding doesn't come with an increase in state support for higher education, disadvantaged and underrepresented students will suffer the most. If colleges fail to meet projected graduation rates, programs may be cut, courses may be canceled, and instructors may be dismissed. For students, it means
wrap up as well. I'd appreciate it, please.
Pardon me?
If you could start to wrap up, I'd appreciate
yes.
it. Thanks.
For students, it will have fewer courses to choose from, fewer academic advisors to guide them, and fewer resources and services to help them succeed. In the long run, this downward spiral may impede degree attainment, not promote it. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Dr. Fury, it's been a while since I was in your classroom.
Oh, wow. Now I'm in deep trouble.
No. I think I am. Please.
I'm totally thrown off with that one.
My name is Dr. Kevin Fury. I'm an economics instructor at Chemeketa Community College. And during 2012 and 2014, I was the community college faculty representative at the State Board of Education, where performance-based funding came up on a number of occasions. Thank you, Chairman Reed and the committee, for allowing me to speak today. As an economist, we're trained to look at systems and look for perverse incentives and outcomes that weren't what people were planning, and I want to look at a couple of them here. One of the ways of boosting the number of graduates, unfortunately, is reducing the standards of grading standards of faculty. And this is going to happen with this type of a system, regardless of whether the college puts pressure on faculty or not. When you have this system in place, part-time faculty who have very little employment protection are going to feel as if their jobs are threatened if they flunk too many students. As grading standards of part-time instructors go down, the grading standards, this is going to put pressure on the grading standards of full-time faculty. And quite frankly, in a world of competition between the community colleges for funding, the idea that colleges aren't going to put pressure on faculty, I think, is magical thinking, especially for those who start losing money. At Chemeketa Community College, in very small and subtle ways, this type of pressure started to occur 3 years ago when this first showed up at the State Board of Education. The second thing is outcomes-based models assume that the quality of students are distributed randomly throughout the state. But we know that students who come from poor social economic backgrounds are less prepared for college than their more well-to-do colleagues. And what outcomes-based funding does is to create sort of a perverse NASCAR race, where some teams are given fast cars and some teams are given slow cars. And then we run the race, and the winners of that race get a larger share of the prize money. And then the teams are required to take that prize money and to plow it back to make their cars faster. And therefore, we run the race again and again and again, and the outcome is going to be that those who most need resources to be able to compete in our society are going to get less and less and less. And those who least need them are going to get more and more and more. Finally, if College A finds some particular system that works, it would be best for the state of Oregon if they were to share that information with everybody. But in a outcomes-based system, what would be best for College A is to keep that information secret and profit from it year after year after year. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. With a mind for the short remaining time, are there any quick questions or comments for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your perspective and your testimony. Our final panel is Greg Kamen. I hope I got that right. Brad Berta. And I've just received word that Jamie Moffitt from the U of O is not here. Hans, so please come forward. Hans is here, I think. And I'll leave it to you if you want to deliver her remarks or we'll commend them to the committee in Olaf. Up to you. Okay, we'll see if she arrives before you gentlemen are finished. Please go ahead.
You want to start?
Please. Good morning, Chair Reed. My name is Brad Berta. I'm the Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Oregon Institute of Technology. I've been asked to testify this morning about the impacts that the outcome-based funding model has on the regional and polytechnic universities. We call them the true universities. I was a member of the technical work group, so I am very familiar with the model itself, the process that was used to arrive at that model. And before I begin, I'd like to do a special thank you to Brian Fox and also to Andrew Rogers. Brian for his leadership in reaching a model, and Andrew, who was the guy behind the scenes actually doing the construction of the model itself. It was a very collaborative process. All seven of the universities had input into the model. I think we worked through some of the angst that was discussed earlier and have come up with a model that I think is fair and equitable. I think it's a model that is an improvement upon the resource allocation model that we've used in the past. But there are unintended consequences, and I'd like to spend just a moment talking about two. First of all, speaking from Oregon Tech's point of view, we have high-cost programs and also high-demand programs, and they're very expensive to actually deliver. And when I look at the revenue coming from the outcome-based funding model, again, tied to with our tuition and other revenue resources, we're not going to be able to balance the budget this next coming year. And that is not the fault of the outcome-based funding model. The problem is, and I think you've heard this from others, is there's not enough state support coming into the system, so we're not redistributing funds amongst the universities and having funds to actually appropriately move toward the outcomes the state needs. And so really, when I look at the $670 million from the co-chairs, plus the additional $12 million that the true universities will be getting to help supplement shared services, it's still not enough to balance the budget at Oregon Tech for this upcoming year. So I implore you to please come up with additional funding for higher education. I think it is critical to meet the needs of the state. The second thing I'd like to talk about for just a moment is, I think Ben brought this up, and that's the perverse incentive of maybe decreased quality in education. I want to make you aware that in the university system, the Provost Council, all my colleagues, along with the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, and HEC are working to ensure that that becomes part of the evaluation of all of the universities. And so we're working to make sure that we can put enough stopgaps in place to make sure that quality is not sacrificed in terms of the outcomes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. President.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg Heyman. I'm the president of Lynn Benton Community College. I'm also a member of the Quality Education Commission. I'm here to talk with you a little bit about my belief in outcomes funding as a part of a strategy for improved effectiveness of higher education in Oregon. Outcomes funding is simply, I think, a clear connection between the resources we invest in something we value and the outcomes that we hope to receive from that work. I would encourage us, and I'll say, if there were such a thing as just passionate, mission-driven institutions, community colleges are those institutions. And so the idea that somehow you can manipulate money and make us do something we don't believe in and is, I think, stops a conversation that needs to happen. What we really need, and what I believe outcomes funding can do, is enable us to do things in a more balanced manner. Enrollment funding reflects one of many outcomes that we desire as a very complex, comprehensive organization. Outcomes, I would say that enrollment is a pretty good indicator of our access mission, but access isn't our only mission. We are committed to providing that kind of education that actually changes the cultural and economic position of our students after they are with us. We want students to have better lives, to be able to provide better for themselves, for their families, to make different kinds of contributions to their communities and to their state. And completion is a significant part of our accomplishing that. And so the idea that we would have a funding model that would more broadly represent our mission and not just access, I think is a reasonable pursuit and one that I am very supportive of. I do know that there are many discussions yet to be had in order to move us to the right plan for that. But I just want to give you a couple examples from my institution that I think perhaps illustrate how this works. So 2 years ago, my institution went through a very significant financial reduction in excess of about 10% of our budget.
And we had to make very difficult decisions about how we would balance our budget and continue to serve our mission. And one of those things we had to decide was, are we going to make a reduction in area that would have an immediate impact on FTE, on enrollment, versus a reduction on someone who we might need in order to support the students that we have towards success? If Representative Johnson were still here, I would refer to his question. Perhaps an academic advisor that doesn't produce FTE but might help us be more successful, that student. We try to balance that, those decisions, and I think all of our schools do try to balance that within the funding that we receive. But I have to admit that we were very careful not to do things that would directly and immediately affect enrollment. And I think that was the right thing for us to do as an institution, given the way in which we were funded. I can't tell you that it's the right thing to do in the absence of that. And I think those are the things that we need to be talking about. I think I would add to the career technical area, very expensive programs for us as well. We're committed to expanding our opportunities in the career technical area. That's an expensive proposition for us. Career technical students complete at a much higher rate than our lower division transfer students, but it's an expensive proposition for us to shift our resources in that direction. To have some component of our funding related to completion would assist us in that effort. One other area, we did an assessment of the number of credits that our students have when they graduate. Most of our programs are about 90, 95 credits, and the average number of credits, I think, came in at about 126. We would like to see students move more efficiently and effectively through their educational experience with this, give them some space to experiment, but also provide them with the clear advising and support that would get them through that program less expensively for them and for us. And we believe that if we had the capacity, I think, to be funded in ways that are more broadly represented our mission, that we'd be making those decisions differently. Thank you,
Mr. President. Appreciate your testimony. We're nearing the end. Hans, doesn't look like your colleague is here, and we'd be glad to hear from you, or we can point to Olas, either one.
Hi. Very quickly, Chair Reed, members of the committee, on behalf of the HEC, or at the request of the HEC, we did want to, on behalf of the University of Oregon, acknowledge our strong support for the move towards outcomes-based funding. As has been mentioned numerous times this morning, the work that went into the process around developing the new funding formula was incredibly detailed and thoughtful and collaborative, and the commission deserves excellent praise for that effort and the time that it took to bring a group together. As I have noted to the commission in the past, the way that the work group members were selected, you put a bunch of finance folks and one chemist in a room based on academic background, and they either could have come up with a bomb or a funding formula, and they came up with an allocation formula. So in terms of the University of Oregon, we see this as the natural next step and extension of the restructuring in higher education that has gone on in this state in the last several years, looking at how we can use state dollars to encourage investments in underrepresented first generation and minority populations, as well as rural students who often find barriers to access to higher education, and using our state dollars and investments to drive institutions to provide opportunity for those students is something we value significantly. So again, apologies that Jamie was not able to be here this morning, but I will submit her comments as well as the testimony that our president delivered before the commission to the committee for your consideration.
Thank you, and we'll make sure those get on the list. Thanks, Victoria. Any quick comments or questions for this panel? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to say I do appreciate Dr. Furry's comments, because I think they sort of captured a couple of my concerns as well. But I think, again, how we sort of look at these and work them into our eventual analysis would be great. So.
Thank you very much. I think for myself, one of the most beneficial aspects of this hearing is the fact that we're all better equipped to deal with the complexities and technical details that you're working through. And I can say with some confidence that we'd like to continue the conversation into the interim and get some regular updates from the commission and others. Any last comments from the committee? Right on time. Thank you very much.
You
close the informational meeting, and we are not going to meet on Friday, but I do want to make an important announcement for you. On Monday, we're going to have, I think, what promises to be a very interesting and informational and informative hearing on the free community college concept that's been working its way through the Senate. And the reason I bring that up is that we're fortunate to have a national expert who is going to testify by Skype, but she has a very, very tight window from 8:30 to 8:45. So please do all you can to be here right on time. I want to start right at 8:30 so we maximize our time with her remotely. With that, unless there's anything else, we're adjourned. See you 8:30 sharp on Monday, please.
Thank you.
Thanks. 8:30 sharp on Monday, please.
Thank you.
Thanks.